Hello and welcome to the Undiplomatic Podcast. I am Julia Gledhill, your rather inconsistent interlocutor on this podcast, and for that I apologize. But today I am exercising my co-host privileges to welcome my colleague Madeline McMurray to discuss the environmental impacts of territorial disputes in the South China Sea. Madeline is a researcher in the Environmental Security Program at the Stimson Center. She also happens to be my office mate, which means I've had the privilege of learning quite a bit about illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing during my time here at Stimson. In fact, when you see me in my office, that is Madeline Sess behind me. Previously, Madeline was a land and environmental defender research assistant at the State Department, focusing on extractive cases in Latin America. She has also done research in the Ohio State University's Departments of History and Political Science. Madeline served as a member of the Emerging Leaders Council at the Ohio Environmental Council and as policy research intern at the Ohio State House. Madeline, welcome to the podcast.
It's really good to be on. I'm frequently kicked out of our office so Julia can record these. So it's really awesome to be on the podcast now.
I still kicked you out, but for this reason, for you to be a guest. So
yes, it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Actually, you offered for the record.
I did. I always do.
I am so stoked to have you on Undiplomatic, long anticipated, to discuss an issue that's super complicated, one that I have grappled with for a long time. We were just discussing how prevalent the South China Sea discussion was going back to the 2016 election. And I'm stoked to talk about this from an environmental perspective because I don't often hear that being sort of the lens through which people approach this issue. The South China Sea is obviously a critical region for several reasons, not least among them, the incredible amount of trade that happens there. But can we start off by setting the stage a little bit? Will you tell us about the natural resources that are prevalent in the South China Sea?
For sure. So the South China Sea is one of the most biodiverse seascapes in the entire world. It rivals that of the Coral Triangle. As a result, fisheries production is a primary export commodity from the South China Sea. Approximately 50% of the world's fishing vessels traverse the South China Sea and fish there. About 12% of global fish catch comes from the South China Sea. But in addition, it's very resource rich in natural gas and oil. So there's a lot of oil and natural gas production. And that's kind of another dimension of the territorial claims issue that we can get into a little bit later in states kind of exploring for liquefied natural gas and oil. Other than that, it's very strategic, as you mentioned, for transport of goods and trade. $3 trillion passes through the South China Sea each year in trade, and 55% of liquefied natural gas trade occurs in the seascape. So very critical economically, very critical for global trade, and also very resource rich.
Got it. Yeah. So there's a lot of reasons why countries are interested in and committed to staking claims in this region. So you recently published a piece with the Stimson Center on how territorial disputes relate to overfishing. Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship? Is it mutually reinforcing? Does one exacerbate the other? What does that look like?
So this might get a little winding, but I'm going to do my best to be concise given how many territorial claims there are in the South China Sea. But to start, it's really important to note that the modern iteration of the territorial disputes that we know today really began in the 20th century, but accelerated in the 70s and 80s. That's important to note because during that time, the UN Charter of the Law of the Sea was being negotiated in the 80s, which gives states within their exclusive economic zone the sovereign right to exploit natural resources. In addition, during this same period, China began to what's called offshore its fishing industry. So China has the largest distant water fleet in the world. These fishing operations occur offshore, so past 12 nautical miles within the 200-mile exclusive economic zone where you can exploit natural resources. So offshoring also refers to fishing on the high seas. So during the 70s and 80s, China's domestic fisheries collapsed and they offshored their fisheries into the South China Sea and really began fishing there. And as a result, you start to see territorial claims being overtly made in the 70s with some very contentious interactions. And this has kind of ebbed and flowed up into the modern iteration of what we know now to be the South China Sea territorial disputes. When it comes to modern fishing, I would say they're very mutually reinforcing. When you're on the high seas, there's a few different ways in which you can stake a territorial claim in contested areas. And one of them is natural resource extraction. Fisheries are often referred to, or fish are often referred to, as a common pool resource, mm-hmm. which means that there needs to be a lot of collaboration, cooperation to sustainably extract them. Otherwise, people will act, or actors act, in their own self-interest. There's going to be a lot of production of fisheries. There's not going to be a lot of exploitation, because frankly, there's a lot of fish in the South China Sea, and states in the region have an incentive to exploit them and to kind of export those fish for consumption as far as the United States. So in a lot of ways, it has to do with asserting territorial claims in contested waterways, you know, diverting fishing fleets, amongst other things.
Got it. And to be clear, there are 7 countries that make territorial claims in the South China Sea. Is that right?
The main actors are China, Taiwan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia. So really, really 6. And your most contentious actors, the ones you're going to see in the news the most, are going to be the PRC, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Vietnam.
Got it. Okay. And so something that you write about in your piece is the militarization of fisher folk. Mm-hmm. How exactly does that work? You've alluded to it a little bit in your intro comments, but I am curious to hear more.
So there's a couple different mechanisms. The first one, to really start off, is there's just a lot of fishing vessels in the South China Sea, and states in the region spend approximately $20 billion per year on fishing subsidies, really to support their industrial fleet and to make sure that there are a lot of vessels at sea, and that way they can really get the most catch. Fisheries are very important. The result of this is you have a lot of vessels that are economically unproductive and really need something to do other than just sit there. And so there's a lot of instances of states kind of diverting their fishing fleets to stake territorial claims in contested waters. Indonesia, I believe in 2016, during a period of contentious interactions around the Natuna Islands of China, explicitly redirected its fishing fleet to fish around the Natuna Islands to assert territorial claims. So that's kind of one way. You have a lot of vessels with a lot of time and governments that have the incentive to stake their territorial claims and to be the ones to get the most fish, if you will. The other way, and maybe the most, I would say, reported on, would be maritime militias. So these are kept by Vietnam and China. And since they're not officially part of the military of either of these nations, they fall into kind of a legal gray area. So the Chinese Navy trains the maritime militia members that operate in the South China Sea, but they're not funded via military spending. They're funded via subsidies for their vessels and trained more informally. And similarly for Vietnam, but a little less developed, and more so that you have militia units that operate on vessels. They tend to be civilian fisher folk that are hired and trained. As a result, they're militarized, and they know that one of their objectives is to combat IUU fishing by mm-hmm. other claimant states, to assert territorial claims, and to kind of be able to fight should it come to that in the contested waterways. So that's the direct securitization of fisher folk. In addition, you also have the securitization of the seascape more broadly, and this is kind of done through artificial island building, primarily by China and Vietnam. It supports their maritime domain awareness to build military infrastructure on what are coral atolls and archipelagos throughout the South China Sea. It allows them to survey other vessels, and additionally, it gives them kind of a vantage point to dock their fishing vessels when they're not patrolling the high seas.
I'm going to display my ignorance about the seascape.
No, it's
what is a coral atoll?
A coral atoll is basically a coral reef system that really in part sits close to the top of the ocean. For this podcast, that's what's important.
It's, okay.
It's basically a place where nations will dredge sand and other coral materials from this kind of elevated coral surface that on an otherwise kind of vacant seascape. It's very important that for states to be able to kind of control and patrol around these atolls as their physical kind of land, and it's otherwise the high seas. And so both Vietnam and China in particular have partaken in extensive land reclamation. The Asia Maritime Transparency Institute at CSIS does a lot of really good monitoring and reporting on this if you're more interested in the land reclamation side of things. But the strategic goal of it is if you are building infrastructure on this atoll, it can't be claimed by someone else. And in addition, China in particular installs a lot of surveillance equipment to monitor vessels to have more maritime domain awareness as well.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So I didn't realize that part of the securitization of fishers had to do with the fact that they didn't have enough fishing to do. Is this because of declining fish populations as a result of said secure? It seems like a vicious cycle there. If you're securitizing fisher folks so that they're fishing more than they would otherwise to make territorial claims, then you're also depleting the fish population faster than you might otherwise. Is that the right way to characterize it?
Yes, exactly. So what the kind of the trend you see, especially in the South China Sea, but really globally, we're seeing this trend in a lot of other seascapes, is you see a rise in what's called fishing capacity. So there's more vessels, there's more equipment being used at sea, there's more fisher folk that are active, but you have stagnant and not growing catch rates, which means that what's happening is they're targeting more and more down the food chain. So as you fish kind of the bigger fish, the more desirable fish, to maintain that constant catch rate in the face of declining fish stocks, you kind of have to catch more and more, or less and less desirable fish, if you will. So it's kind of feeding into this ecosystem collapse. And like you mentioned, it feeds a really vicious cycle. And it's part of why the vicious cycle continues, is because of the competition over the scarce resources.
Right. And I can imagine that domestically, this is really a sticky issue because you have so much cultural know-how, historical significance to the fishing, you know, industry in these countries, whether it be China, Vietnam, or otherwise. And so I would imagine local populations would be supportive of subsidization of the industry, even given kind of the detrimental impacts on the fish population. And not to go off course too much, but as I think the resident vegan on this podcast, I do care quite a bit about commercial fishing. Now, it sounds like, you know, even with subsidization of the fishing industries in these countries, does that translate to the type of commercial fishing that we see done by American companies? Like, are these aren't 70-mile nets, I can't imagine, in the South China Sea.
So these are your commercial fishing vets. So there's going to be a lot of bycatch, which is like if they're grinding. Okay. So they're very destructive. And one of the things I talk about in my piece is that when you have this fierce competition and declining fish stocks, it also incentivizes more destructive fishing methods that can get more catch for less money. One example of this is bottom trawling. 66% of fish catch, or marine fish catch in Vietnam, for example, is caught via a bottom trawler. And how this works is there's really, really large nets attached to vessels in kind of offshore, but medium offshore. So not as far out on the high seas, still within the EEZ. And these nets drag up sediment on the seabed while catching like a lot of fish, very damaging for natural ecosystems. And there's increasingly a reliance on those sorts of forms of catching fish. Even though it destroys the ecosystem, that doesn't matter. It gets more fish catch and it's less expensive than your kind of legal rates.
Okay, so it sounds like there is the overlap with the commercial fishing that I'm thinking of.
And that's actually, to at least to me, someone that also, in addition to the kind of the environmental security aspect, a part of that comes into human security. So with the South China Sea issue, something that's frequently overlooked when you kind of read the headlines are the very large number of fishers and livelihoods that rely on fishing, and specifically in the regions bordering the South China Sea. There's about 190 million people in these countries that rely explicitly on fisheries resources in the South China Sea for their livelihoods, whether that be working on a vessel or working in fisheries processing in the coastal areas. And 86% of fishers are small scale. They're not going to be your big commercial fishers. The vast majority are going to be small scale fishers. And you're right, they do support fishery subsidies because of the perception that they will benefit from them, when in reality, $9 billion of fishery subsidies go towards the industrial fleet versus only $1 billion in South China Sea claimant countries for small scale fishers.
Got it. Okay, so yeah, this is a really similar story to the commercialization of seafood and meat production in the United States as well, which I know much more about. But I will say, like, I've traveled a good amount in Southeast Asia, which we've discussed before, and it was definitely prevalent and really out front in terms of my experience and seeing the role that fishing communities do have in Southeast Asia in particular. That's mostly where I've traveled. So it sounds like the sort of tension, territorial disputes in the South China Sea have actually driven commercialization in a really detrimental way for small scale fisheries, which is really scary and sad. So you talked a little bit about the distinction between, you know, there's securitization of fisher folk, and then there's also like actual militias that, mm-hmm. from what I understand, if I'm characterizing your comments correctly, are, you know, participating in sort of gray zone tactics. Can mm-hmm. you talk about the legal implications of that and sort of the legal landscape that these types of fisher folk are operating in the South China Sea?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult because there are a lot of different levels of kind of like regulation to mm-hmm. the fisheries issue, to conservation, and then also to international law. So fisher folk themselves that are incorporated into maritime militias operate in a legal gray area under the law of naval warfare. They're not officially incorporated into the state's military, but they still are militias and they still kind of exert that territorial control, and they're still considered a kind of military actor by these sure. states. And so in a lot of ways, they're able to dodge your traditional like legal ramifications of directing your military to kind of provoke conflict. But more broadly, the legal implications of these issues, it's kind of made the South China Sea in many ways an ungovernable seascape. Many other subnational or sub-ocean seascapes like the South China Sea have what's called a regional fisheries management organization, which is a collection of governments in that bordering that seascape will send fisheries negotiators. There are fisheries diplomats to kind of negotiate on different laws and agree on who is going to enforce what where. Because of the fierce territorial competition that is in many ways fed into by the securitization of the seascape, there's no appetite to have an RFMO in the South China Sea, and there's very little appetite to kind of collaborate at the regional level or to kind of enforce laws at a regional level. The domestic level is very different. There have been different tactics employed by states to try to kind of combat the maritime militia issue. So I'll kind of maybe give two illustrative examples. One would be the highly publicized campaign by Indonesia from around 2016 to 2020, where if they found a foreign vessel to be fishing within their EEZ or within their claimed area, they would basically just warn the vessel, claim the vessel and take it, their fisheries enforcement vessels would kind of take it over, and then they would blow it up. And this really did, I mean, it deterred fishing within their EEZ. It did work, but it was very controversial as it's a militarized enforcement tactic. It's not like an ecosystem-based enforcement tactic. And then another example would be kind of, you have countries that interdict vessels at sea, kind of similar to what Indonesia was doing, but they kind of will arrest the fishers, make a diplomatic note. The Philippines has made over 400 since 2016, saying these fishers are fishing within our EEZ. We don't allow that. And then they're charged and then extradited back to wherever it is that they came from. So different levels, whether it's regional or at a state level fisheries policy sort of thing.
Got it. So that might explain a little bit why, among other reasons, the United States it doesn't say a whole lot about the South China Sea and how best to address these territorial disputes.
Right. Outside of kind of, I mean, obviously there's the mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. So they're very supportive of the Philippines, but they kind of tread, I think, very lightly. Under Trump, there's been a little bit more hardline stance, especially given the laying off of many of the South China Sea regional experts at the State Department. People that would specialize in regional cooperation are being laid off. So there's less of kind of like regional expertise that could put forth efforts to make laws more collaboratively in the seascape and enforce them. But it's a very difficult issue, especially as an outside actor that China has accused of being an agitator. And that's the role of the United States to China in the South China Sea.
Right. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about how different countries approach this issue, the militarization of fisher folk, and how this drives overfishing and therefore depletes fish populations in the South China Sea. why should the world care? Why does this matter beyond Ocean's Rock?
Beyond Ocean's Rock. That's a very good question. I would say there's a few different reasons. The first, of course, would be seafood. The South China Sea supplies 12% of the world's catch. The Asian region contributed about, I think, contributes about 47% of marine products for human consumption. So if you eat a lot of seafood, then protecting our oceans, including the South China Sea, should be very important to you, and finding ways to collaboratively and sustainably regulate that resource. Another reason would be if you're, you know, a DC-based person, I'm sure you're very familiar with like the issue of Taiwan and China. This is a big thing that comes up when you're discussing that. So as a policy person, that's kind of how I first got introduced to this issue. And it's still a reason, I think, to care about it very deeply. The other thing would be there's a lot of human trafficking involved in fishing vessels in the South China Sea, because these vessels need to protect their bottom line. There's a large population of migratory labor created by the fierce competition and the decline of the fish stocks. There's ample reporting on, you know, being in slavery at sea. I think that those are good reasons for a global audience to care. You don't want your seafood to be caught, you know, under contentious means or to fuel conflict. And in addition, you don't want it to be caught with forced labor. To me, that's always been a really straightforward reason to care about this issue.
Yeah, no, I would say that that's an incredibly compelling argument. I didn't realize human trafficking was a part of this story. So in terms of tackling some of the issues at play here, and I understand that this is a big question, but what might better regional cooperation on sustainability and environmental protection look like in this region?
It is a big question, but it's a good question. And I'm going to speak to kind of some of my interactions with people in the region. For some context for kind of the listeners, yeah. I previously and continue to work on a project that just assesses really fisheries and maritime security in the South China Sea and the Sulawesi seascape, which is another seascape pretty close to the South China Sea. But that doesn't really matter for this podcast. Anyway, but this process has involved interviewing a lot of in-country experts that work in the fisheries industry or that work in conservation. And some of the things that we repeatedly hear from them is that a really good way to get regional collaboration going is to use science diplomacy to build trust. This is something that's been advocated for what feels like years. You can find some reporting on this going all the way back to 2016. But like I said, because there is no RFMO, there's no data on fish stocks or real assessments that have been made regionally since like the 1950s. So something that was repeatedly advocated for when we would speak with people in the region was to promote things like collaborative fish stock assessments, to support technical capacity building at the regional level. So better, I think, regional collaboration would look like following through on a lot of the plans of action that have been made in the past. So for example, the ASEAN Sectoral Working Group on Fisheries has had a regional plan of action to sustainably regulate fisheries in the ASEAN region. But in the South China Sea, it's not really something that's directly collaborated on. So kind of elevating and changing the narrative on the South China Sea. These governments need to feel it's politically popular and important to protect the ecosystem, and it's politically popular and important to better regulate their fisheries. And one of the ways this can be done is to kind of fund scientific efforts to make them look at the issue and say, this is the status of the environment. It's the ecosystem is collapsing. And if you really want to continue to exploit the natural resources, if you want that to be your bottom line for your economy, then you're going to need to better manage the resource because it's not working for anyone. There's a really good study that was done at the University of British Columbia that found that if you reduce fishing capacity in the South China Sea by between 50 and 60%, then it gives ample amount of time for fish stocks to actually regenerate. And so one of those first steps could be like changing the narrative on fishery subsidies to reduce the number of vessels. And that could kind of get the ball rolling on better regional collaboration on like fish stock assessments, at least. Yeah, I have that question. Very long and winding.
No, it did answer the question. I had one follow-up for you, which is, can you remind us what an RMFO is?
A regional fisheries management organization governs seascapes and fisheries resources within that seascape. In other seascapes, this could be regulating a specific fish species like skipjack tuna, a migratory species, or it could look more like just regulating a seascape. In the South China Sea for a long time, there's been kind of calls for an ecosystem approach to fisheries management, which means looking at the entirety of the seascape and managing it collaboratively that way, rather than maybe delineating maritime boundaries. And then that would have to be done through something like an RFMO. If it's not an RFMO directly, it would have to be something that is kind of built off of the RFMO structure, or mm-hmm. things like collaborative protections for, I believe, the Great Barrier Reef, where you have multiple kind of nation states that are patrolling and enforcing different fisheries management regulations.
Got it. Okay, that is so helpful for me and for listeners, mm-hmm. hopefully. My mm-hmm. follow-up question was actually, what is the historical precedent for regional cooperation on fishing in the South China Sea? Obviously, these territorial disputes are longstanding, but
yes.
These countries have, and their people have fished in this region for a very, very long time. And so theoretically, there is kind of some kind of framework in which we can operate on how to yes. do it sustainably. And so, you know, what's the historical precedent for that? Is it through mm-hmm. the RMFO process? And I'll tack another one on, forgive me. We talked a little bit about the fishers themselves being supportive of subsidization of the fishing industry, mm-hmm. because, you know, and this is a reasonable assumption to make, the idea is that it would benefit those fishers themselves, even if they are not the commercial fisher mm-hmm. folk, and they are perhaps engaging in more historic, culturally kind of appropriate, mm-hmm. sustainable fishing practices on a small yeah. scale. I mean, is there like a solidarity story here? Mm. What does that look like? How do fishers themselves weigh in, if at all, on returning back to what I imagine would be a more cooperative framework? Or I'm making assumptions here, but hopefully my question makes sense. I'm curious about the history of this and what that looks like for the fishers themselves.
Right. There's a couple different regional frameworks. And then there's also some attempts at direct bilateral kind of frameworks built between different claimant states. So I'll touch on both. Regional frameworks are a bit all over the place, as you can yeah. probably imagine. So you have the UN Charter of the Law of the Sea, which, like I mentioned earlier, kind of dictates a state's exclusive economic zone. Through that, you can do things like UN arbitration rulings. You can go to the court and you can kind of directly stake, this is my claim to this space. This is how this country violated that claim. And that's what we saw in 2013, the Philippines initiated this process. And in 2016, it was found that internationally under the UN Charter of the Law of the Sea, their claims and their rights to exploit resources within a contested area, I believe it was the Scarborough Shoal, fell under their jurisdiction. Mm. So that's one regional framework would be the UN Charter of the Law of the Sea. And then you kind of have explicit regional conservation or fisheries organizations. So you have the Southeast Asian Fisheries Development Center, which was established by ASEAN and mainly focuses on researching specific types of fish biologically. So in terms of like regional collaboration, it doesn't do a lot in terms of policymaking, but it is one of the only extremely positive examples of regional collaboration. It's just only on biological research, if that makes right. sense.
Okay.
And then you have the Asia Pacific Fishery Commission, and the regional plan of action to combat IUU fishing. All of these things, though, pertain to the countries that are involved in this issue more broadly. There is no direct regional mechanism for collaboration on the South China Sea issue unless it is done through a voluntary ministerial level mechanism such as RPOA-IUU, the Regional Plan of Action to Combat IUU Fishing, and they also cover other seascapes. So what this has looked like has been technical capacity building, if you will. So things like building a platform, the ASEAN Sectoral Working Group on Fisheries also has done this, building a platform, for example, to report IUU fishing related offenses and kind of being like, this occurred in the South China Sea. That's one mechanism for regional collaboration, a lot of technical capacity building and things that are very voluntary, if you will.
So- So that's actually like info seeking cooperation, and IUU fishing being illegal, unregulated, unreported. Mm-hmm. So even just coming to a consensus about how big is this issue is what you're saying.
Yeah. So like even doing things like recognizing that many vessels at sea, it's hard to monitor them. So it could be a collaborative effort to install VMS, which is vessel monitoring systems, on your state's vessels. And that can be coordinated at the regional level, but the actual action to implement it has to be popular domestically as well. And that's where a lot of problems arise. There's no binding mechanism for the South China Sea. And given the incentives that states have to protect their fisheries resources, protect where they know there are a lot of fish to be caught by their vessels, it's really, really difficult to get states to comply in the South China Sea specifically, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the question of how much illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing is even happening, you know, you talked about sort of a starting point for cooperation being sort of data generation on that subject. Well, that would require states to then own up to the IUU fishing that they're doing, is what you're saying.
Yeah, right. Which is
that's tricky.
Yeah. It can also involve doing something like assessing a stock amount. And my take on this is that it doesn't always all need to be public immediately. Okay. These states can fund a research project that assesses the stock level data for each different, you know, jurisdiction that is within their state's control. And then they can share that on a government level. One of the reasons why it's so difficult to do it is because if it's made public, and let's say I'm a fisher and I am from, I don't know, like Vietnam, and I see that Indonesia has really, really abundant fish stocks. Yeah. What am I going to do when there's no regional mechanism to combat like my unregulated fishing in their EEZ? I'm going to go and I'm going to fish there because I want to make money. It's getting harder to find fish. I know they have fish. I want to fish there. Yeah. It's really as simple as that. It's very opportunistic. And this is what we see with a lot of natural resources at the end of the day. It's just harder with fish because it's at sea and the fish don't stay in one place.
They swim around.
They like to swim around. And the other mechanism, which has seen some success, I will say, has been direct bilateral agreements. There's been quite a few of these, the most successful being the Gulf of between Vietnam and China. There was for a very short period of time a specific fisheries bilateral agreement, but it fell apart because they couldn't agree on enforcement and where people's boundaries ended. And other bilateral agreements that we've seen more recently, for example, has been Vietnam and Indonesia have recently agreed on maritime security kind of patrols to combat things like IUU fishing and transnational crime. And similarly, we're seeing that now with Indonesia and China recently came out and made a public statement that they're going to collaborate on maritime security. So you see these kind of like bilateral agreements, which historically China is more in favor of, versus these regional mechanisms that don't have any enforcement capacity.
Okay. So we've talked about sort of a few things on this issue. You know, you have worker exploitation and actual human trafficking, you have environmental depletion, you have obviously the territorial dispute part of it all, which you know, we've discussed a lot. What makes this issue urgent right now? You know, why is this something that needs to be resolved in the very near future? I mean, you talked about kind of the economic impacts, the ripple effects, the fact that the South China Sea produces like 12%, I think you said, of the seafood that we eat globally. I mean, it seems to me like these countries will, you know, really suffer economically and you know, therefore generate some domestic political issues if this is not addressed very soon, right? And if you don't have the information on how much biodiversity is suffering, then it's going to be very difficult to regenerate those fish populations.
Right. So this kind of goes back to your second question that you had asked about the small scale fishers. Are there stories of solidarity? I think that the human security aspect and the sheer number of people that rely on the seascape make it a very urgent issue. As a result of the kind of the territorial disputes and the over exploitation of the seascape, the biodiversity hotspot has seen coral reef cover decline by like 16% per decade because it's being destroyed to build land land on these coral atolls to stake claims. And fish stocks since the 1950s have declined by between 70 and 95%. And in our own interviews, yes, between 70 and 95%. And there are estimates at the current exploitation rate by 2045, I believe, it'll drop by another 56%. So we're kind of reaching really critical levels for this seascape because, as it kind of illustrated in my piece, there's just this really repeated incentive to continue exploiting the stocks. And what makes this super urgent is obviously, you know, these stocks are going to keep continuing to decline, but we're also beginning to see the compounding impacts of climate change. There's national level scientific kind of research being done on the impacts of climate change on fish stocks. So, and in this region, not only is it overexploited because of fishing, but the migratory patterns of fish are beginning to change, meaning it's only going to get more difficult to target fish in this seascape. And this is important because 190 million people rely on it for their livelihood. So these are large populations in the coasts of, you know, Vietnam, on the coast of the Philippines, that have historically fished, have relied on it, whether it be working in fish processing, whether it be fishing at sea, or whether it just be something to indirectly pad their income during difficult economic times, which we saw during COVID was an uptick in fishing as a means to kind of pad your income. It takes away this option. And there's some kind of reporting coming out that like small scale fishers in around areas that are kind of that offshore of them is a contested space, like the Scarborough Shoal. Increasingly, fishers are being forced to leave the industry and to migrate to urban areas, or they're being found or they're being put into debt bondage by industrial vessels and moving kind of to the industrial production side of things. So overall, I would say this is a really important issue because of the human security impacts that come when an ecosystem like this collapses.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just so much to be concerned about here. Climate change, worker exploitation, human trafficking, the domestic economic effects and the ripple effects that it'll have on the global economy and consumption of seafood. Just to zoom out a little bit, where would you like to take your research in this realm? What questions are keeping you up at night? Is it the South China Sea? Is it related to fishing globally? What is on your mind these days?
On my mind these days, this is a very good question. I'm frequently kept up at night by the fisheries issue more broadly, because I mean, this is like a joke. No one from the IAU fishing community, I feel like, watches your podcast, like aside from me, maybe, but
you'll have to share this with them.
But it's a joke, like kind of in the IAU fishing community, that like the policy solutions to monitor fishing and like build sustainable fisheries are written. It's just that implementation part is so difficult and even more so in the South China Sea. In terms of where I want to take this research next, we're kind of like looking at doing more research directly on the national level for some of these countries. So whether that be Indonesia or going into the Philippines and kind of getting more into the nitty-gritty on what that policy landscape looks like, because you really can't govern at a regional level if your own country has a lot of gaps in their enforcement. So kind of figuring out, where are these enforcement gaps? Are there any opportunities for learning between countries, and what are the ways in which we can promote that? So that's kind of where my head is at. I'm constantly stressed out about this issue and just natural resource degradation in contested areas more broadly. Yeah, no,
it's definitely scary, something that I'm likewise concerned about. I think, you know, the environmental security impacts of territorial disputes and just geopolitical tension in general. You know, the stat that I always point to in my work is that the DOD emits more greenhouse gases than many other countries. And so it is a climate issue. Mm-hmm. And it definitely concerns me and makes me scared for our future, the kind of climate impacts that we're going to see on the economy, on workers, on food, you know, access. So it really touches everything. And there are many folks, I think, in like the foreign policy space that talk about the environmental aspect of things, because I do think that it's almost like something that's so hard to have fruitful policy discussions about, that it's very mm-hmm. easy to kind of cast it aside and fall into the doomerism of it all. I guess my final question will be for you. What have I not asked that I should have? Do you have any final words for us, things that you would like to leave listeners with on mm-hmm. fishing, on environmental security, on the South China Sea?
Maybe first on environmental security, just to all the listeners out there, the climate is going to be an issue that is going to touch all of your work. If any of you work in any policy space, increasingly climate and environmental issues are going to start to seep into that, because it's just an undeniable fact that we're living in a climate crisis, and it intersects with so many different issues. Like Julia, like you said, with, you know, if the Pentagon or the DOD was a country, it would be like the fourth largest greenhouse gas emitter. Like, that's absolutely yeah. ridiculous. But a few things to kind of leave just on like the fisheries and the ocean side, there are a few causes for hope, which I think it's always good to think about the positive things. The first yes, one would be on a hope. Yeah. The first one would be last week, September 15th, was the first day the World Trade Organization's agreement on fishery subsidies went into effect. And this is designed to regulate the fishery subsidies that go towards fishing in an over-exploited seascape, and kind of sets metrics to begin regulating fishery subsidies. And this is going to be, I think, super impactful in regions like Southeast Asia that put so much money towards fishery subsidies, and really starting to kind of parse out what are the subsidies that are doing what you would think they're supposed to do, and what many people think they're for, supporting, you know, these small scale fishers that need the money, and which portions are going towards industrial vessels that are feeding into this like ecosystem catastrophe. So that's one cause for hope. And I'm going to be following that issue like super closely. I'm a huge supporter of the agreement on fishery subsidies, and I could nerd out on it for a really long time.
I can attest to that.
yeah. But the other one would be the High Seas Treaty went into effect this week as well. So the barriers beyond national jurisdiction, there's officially a mechanism to kind of begin regulating the high seas collaboratively between countries. This kind of writes the script on how we go about doing that. How do we protect the high seas? Parts of the South China Sea are considered the high seas, and so this could be beneficial to that. But just more broadly, it gives the BBNJ Secretariat a framework for kind of approaching areas where collaborative management is necessary, but it's hard to get actors to comply on doing it. So that's another cause for hope. And I would say that in my experience working on environmental and oceans issues, kind of going to those conferences and hearing what people have to say, there's also increasingly a focus on elevating the stories of people on the ground and really taking what they're saying and putting it front and center. And you know, for the South China Sea issue, what this looks like is taking, you know, those small scale fisheries unions, you know, people that work in like local governance units for different like marine areas and fisheries exploitation areas in these countries, you know, them speaking up at conferences saying like, we don't want to necessarily see so much reporting on the security issues. And, you know, the Philippines and China got into another tense interaction. What they want to see is what is happening to you know, these countries' fishing industries, what is happening to the coastal communities that rely on these fisheries resources. So increasingly, there's been kind of like a focus and a spotlight on that kind of stuff. And that's really, really encouraging to see, because I think that's really what this issue needs right now.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear that. I think, you know, people love stories about other people, and it really helps to humanize big, gnarly issues like climate change. I lied. I want to ask you one more question, which is there anything folks in civil society in the United States or elsewhere can do to be supportive of this kind of work at the Simpson Center and elsewhere? Is there any call to action?
I would say, this is a very good question. And we're living in very difficult times to kind of, I think, work in the environmental
And it's, thinking. You know, it's really hard to mobilize on absolutely everything going on.
Yeah, it's really hard to mobilize on everything. But I think from the perspective of Washington, D.C., I think that there is just, like I kind of mentioned before, a disconnect in priorities. And, you know, I've seen this working with people in the region. Like, what I was being told for my officer on the grant for researching IAU fishing was very China hawk, very China is the big bad wolf in the South China Sea, versus people on the ground were saying, you know, there are so many other instances of tense interactions between different vessels from different climate states that just don't make the news. And there are so many examples of other issues that we should be spotlighting, like food, the threat to food security, the threat to human security, the environmental degradation. So I would say, like, if you work on oceans issues, if you are at all interested in the South China Sea issue, think outside the box a little bit. There's so much been written on the security and more of the realist side of things, and start to think about some of those other kind of knockoff effects. And what are the other less flashy mechanisms outside of like military diplomacy, and what are the levers you can pull there to kind of get people to come to the negotiating table? I think that would be my advice to people in policy space: think outside the box and kind of work to elevate those stories.
Great, thank you, Madeline.
You're welcome.
I can certainly agree. I think particularly on climate, Van has made this argument in his new book with Michael Brennis, but yeah, we're going to have to work with China if we have to continue to collaborate on climate action, which, you know, we have done with that country quite a bit. So have so enjoyed having you on Diplomatic.
One more thing. I'm just gonna plug a few things to check out. If you're interested in this issue, my team and our the Environmental Security Program and our Southeast Asia Program wrote a full analysis on maritime security and fisheries in the South China Sea. It's on the Simpson website. It's an IUU fishing risk profile for the South China Sea. There's also a policy recommendations report, kind of derived from a Track 1.5 dialogue with actors in the region. What's really interesting about this is, you know, they're not my recommendations. They're coming from the experts, the people that work on the fisheries issue, the maritime security issue in the South China Sea every single day. And I highly recommend reading it to get those insights. And then lastly, I recently published a piece which the reason Julia asked me on this issue that gets more into the nitty gritty of some of the things I've talked about today.
Thank you, Madeline. I will make sure to put both those resources in the show notes. The environmental security and Southeast Asia teams here at Simpson do such excellent work. So it's been such a pleasure to learn about it and to hear from you today. We hope to have you back on Undiplomatic sometime. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Julia.
Thanks. Bye, folks.
Bye.